Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
We're excited to welcome to the show the researcher and professor of psychology and human performance from the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Paula Silva. Welcome to the show, Paula.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me and having me here.
So before we get into the research, we know you're a Brazilian, so we want to see, is there any sort of volleyball background since we are kind of a volleyball-focused show?
Yeah, I'm embarrassed to say no, but I really love watching it, and I'm a big fan of the Brazilian team.
Yeah, so many good players have come from there.
Yeah.
That's okay. We're okay with one Brazilian who hasn't played volleyball.
Soccer.
There you go. That's number one, right? Yes. Soccer is one, volleyball two.
I do play tennis and run. That's what I do.
Okay.
For sports.
Nice. Net sport, tennis, volleyball, same.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, you've done quite a bit of research on developing anti-fragile performers. Can you take us through what it means to be anti-fragile?
Yeah, I mean, this is the line of research that I've been engaged in for the past, I want to say 4 or 5 years. And what antifragility means is this idea that systems grow under stress. And it's a very sort of typical common property of biological systems in general, not just humans, other animals too. And it kind of gives a nice and different spin on stress, because typically we think of stress as something negative, but also it can be used and leveraged to promote growth. And that's really something that I think intuitively coaches know about, because that's what we do. For instance, when we want to strengthen a muscle, for the muscle to grow, it needs to be exposed to physical challenges and demands. And that's what we call stress. And antifragility is that phenomenon, that property or characteristic of athletes that can actually outperform themselves when they are under stress. And that can be in the short time scale of a game or in the longer time scale of practice and training.
That's a good definition. So I think a lot of coaches would hear that and they would think, oh, that's resilience. Isn't that what a resilient player does? But I think there's a distinction, right?
There is a distinction and a meaningful distinction, because I think the concept of resilience is also really important, and it's a good property to have. But that's sort of bouncing back to your original state once you're stressed. Imagine, you know, stress comes in, maybe you get perturbed, you change a bit, but after you're able to bounce back to your prior level of performance. So you see that there's no growth there. And that's the meaningful distinction. In one case, you know, you're stressed, you get perturbed, but you get back to your level of performance. You preserve your level of performance under stress. That's resilience, right? Let's think about something in volleyball. Imagine one of the goals of the attacker is to kind of hit the ball hard down on the floor. And you can do that and preserve that performance under various defense type of scenarios, right? So you're being stressed by better defenders, worse defenders, and you preserve your ability to do that. But now you can imagine a situation where if you're playing against a really good team, all of a sudden your skill level almost ramps up. That's anti-fragility, right? If you're under stress, you actually get pushed to do better, to develop novel and more refined skills.
So that's the golden ticket, right? That's what every coach, what every athlete is searching for. But how can we as coaches create an environment that facilitates that growth and what you're speaking about?
Yeah, the more I joked with you guys that I have more questions than answers. And I think that is a very interesting question. I'm trying to tackle that in my research. But the idea to me, so far, the suggestion is that you need perceptual motor mechanisms in place, perceptual motor abilities. You need to be able to perceive your environment in ways that engage your motor system and engage or promote actions and adjustments that are appropriate for the context you're in. So it's not about having an idealized way or movement pattern to execute a play, but it's about being able to change that play in accordance to what the context is like. So that implicates to me perception directly. So what coaches can do to do that is, you know, I can't answer that specifically, but given what we know about motor control, you need to promote adaptability through variation in context, variation in challenges, and to an extent that allows and promotes creativity, motor creativity, instead of focusing on one solution and strategy for a particular problem.
And in your experience, does perception need to be verbalized by the athlete, or is it more that they can have that sort of internal perception of what's going on without being able to really express it? Because some of it's just happening so fast on such a subconscious level that we don't need our players to be able to like write a dissertation on why they did skill X. Does that make sense?
Yes. I mean, and it's such an interesting question that actually I think the research so far would suggest that preferably you don't want them to get too overly cognitive about this. I'll give you one example of a research paper, and remind me, I can track it down to send that to you. But if, for instance, you're talking about a player, you're trying to instruct somebody to learn how to use the skiing machine, okay? And you can either provide very simple tips that would allow them to kind of attune to their body and to the equipment in ways that are not at all cognitive, but that would allow them to get the best out of the athlete. But if you then instruct people about how the machine works, how if you press at a particular position, then you get the best out of it. So you're cognitively instructing why they should do X, Y, and Z, performance actually drops. So one, if you do that very explicitly, athletes don't learn as well, or participants in these types of experiments don't learn the task as well. And even after they learn the task, if you then start instructing, you know what, why it's working? Do you know why you're learning? It's because the springboard has this and this mechanical property that if you hit it with this frequency, it's better than if you don't, you know. As soon as you start getting too specific about the whys and what they should pay attention to, performance degrades.
So how do you know you're increasing perception without the athlete? I mean, does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I think you know because you're seeing more adaptation.
Okay. So we just got to trust our eye and strategy. Yeah.
Yeah. Because if you begin to see, for example, that you change the context and you're seeing changes in strategies that are context sensitive in the sense that it's precisely the ones that are required to do the play well, what else, if not perception, could be driving that? Right?
Yeah. John, be the jargon police here. Are we getting too deep on motor learning language, or is this applicable?
No, I think this is really applicable.
Okay, just checking.
Yeah.
Because in my view, put very simply, imagine you change the defense setting. You have various formations possible. And then somebody has to do the strike, right? If you see changes in the strike with changes in defense organizations and formations that are precisely the ones that are needed to get the play right every time, how could this be guided by something that's not the ability of the athlete to couple or to change their actions and solutions as a byproduct of what they're seeing the defense doing, the defense formation, right?
Yeah. So I want to go back to the idealized movement pattern, which is like a traditional form of coaching. And I think a lot of coaches think, you know, I'm going to have them change their movement pattern, and that's going to be really uncomfortable. It's going to induce stress. It's going to be hard for them to make this change. So through this process, you know, they're becoming more anti-fragile or more resilient. I guess what would be your pushback on something like that?
A couple. So number one, what we know, if I send the question back to you.
Yep.
What we call an idealized pattern for anything, the soccer kick, the volleyball strike, the volleyball serve, whatever you say, when you see the athlete actually performing in the wild, is it possible to always use that particular idealized strategy?
Probably not.
Probably not, right? Yeah. because depending on how they, you know, who is by them, by their side, how the ball came to them, you know, what the formation is on the other side.
Right.
You simply cannot do it.
Yeah.
Right. So this idealized form is typically picked out from studies that have a very controlled context, very controlled conditions. And then they say, oh, this way of doing it is the way that gets you the ball farther. It's the way that gets, you know, exploits better your ability to generate force, blah, blah, blah. Except what is not considered is the fact that that idealized context in which all of these things are true are very rarely the context in which the players are embedded in during a real game. Right?
Yeah.
So this is my first pushback against like the excessive focus on idealized form. And what you're saying is that, you know, you may say, what you're saying is not untrue, that if you teach athletes how to perform the idealized form, you're challenging them and they're learning to produce the idealized form in the context you're training them to produce the idealized form.
Yeah.
And they're becoming more anti-fragile in their ability to produce that particular form under perhaps more a variety of conditions, right? They're becoming better at producing that force, that pattern. But I would hold off on calling that anti-fragility, because anti-fragility is about your ability to perform well under various conditions, which is not just about movement form, which is not just about idealized movement patterns. It is about being able to score. It's about getting the ball down on the floor. It is about, you know, serving the where nobody can catch the ball. That's that's what is, I think anti-fragility needs to be characterized at that individual environment complex and not at the individual level of the movement, because the movement in and of itself does not guarantee performance under natural contexts.
Yeah. Do you think it makes a difference if, say, I'm probably getting this off topic, but like you're using the constraints-led approach towards an idealized movement pattern? I know maybe that goes against like the affordances, and but what if it's like, yeah, through in that context?
Yes. So let me just say one additional thing before I answer that. There is evidence, and I can also send you a paper on that, which is really neat, that if you have a person doing a task, and again, it's not a very high level task, but people are shooting darts on a target. And if in one situation you stress the form of the movement, that's one condition in the experiment. And in the other condition, you stress eye at the target, try to get the dart on the target, and just do instructions related to the performance side of things, the task performance side of things, and not movement form. Do you know what happens? In case A, where you give instructions about movement form, people get better at producing that movement form at the expense of task performance. They make more errors. They get better. They get less variable movement patterns. They approach the idealized form that you tell them to produce. In the other case, they get better at the task. They make less errors, but at the cost of greater variation in movement patterns. They use the idealized pattern sometimes, but sometimes they don't. But this is not a bad thing, because that variation is what is guaranteeing the performance of the task that matters in the end.
Nice. Yeah, that's that's great.
So one of the things that you're saying that's really interesting is, what about we use the constraint-led approach in a way that drives individuals to an idealized form? Again, I worry about idealized form because of what I mentioned.
Yeah.
But it is undeniable that there are certain strategies that work better than other strategies. And in the side of injury, for instance, when you land from a jump, for example, if you land from a jump with a huge valgus, there is an increased chance that you can get an ACL injury, for example. That is something.
What was that word? Valgus?
The valgus is when your knee moves in. You know, when that's a huge injury risk for the knee ligament. So then when you land, instead of landing with your legs straight, you land with your legs going inward, for example.
Right.
You might want to teach people not to land that way because it is a risk.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you can try and use strategies to promote that movement without talking about the movement form itself in and of itself. I'll tell you one way we have done this here that we're researching is you can imagine a VR task where you have a display on the screen. All right.
Yep. Yeah. Virtual reality, right? Yep.
Virtual reality. You have a display on the screen that when you land, imagine you're doing a squatting exercise that when you squat appropriately, when you don't put your knee inwards or when you don't distribute the, when you distribute the weight appropriately between the two legs, when you don't lean forward too much with your trunk, all of those biomechanical characteristics of landing that increase your risk for injury. Imagine that when you do everything right, you see a square on the screen. And then your instruction to the participant, to your athlete is squat so as to produce a square. But the square is mapped onto a bunch of parameters in your movement that you want the athlete to avoid. But you're not telling them when they're training, oh, pay attention on your knee.
Yeah.
Don't lean your trunk. Distribute your weight appropriately in the two legs. Make sure your hip is going backwards instead of your knee forward. You're giving, can you imagine the number of instructions in movement form that you need to give? And we know that that will promote an internal focus that's bad for performance. You're going to be focusing on your body too much, and that's bad for performance. So this would be a strategy of push the focus out to a stimulus in the environment. And that stimulus is guiding what you do. So you just tell the person, produce a square. And when the square is there, it means you're doing it right. If you see some distortions, it means you need to do something different. But it's led by a stimulus in the environment. In the same vein, you can think about what can I change in the environment, in the setup, that will make particular solutions just not effective and other solutions highly effective, right? And then you can push people naturally to those solutions instead of instructing them about them, instead of telling them, oh, see, you didn't push your arm back enough or you didn't raise your arm enough. Because then instead of the athlete be thinking about the arm, you get the athlete thinking about, oh, this doesn't work. I need to do something different with my body here, and let them discover, right? Through the changes in context.
Right. That's a great example. We need a volleyball version of that square. So I think you've covered a lot of them, but I don't know if there's more of like common traps that coaches might fall into that would lead to more fragile performers. Obviously an internal focus of attention seems like maybe that's number one, but if you want to go through some of the things you'd see.
I think that the, you know, a trap, I'm sure there are many traps around there, but I don't want to claim I know more than coaches. Coaches do great, right? Look at the athletes we're producing.
Some of them,
right? Yeah. But the idea is to make our athletes even better and more adaptable. I think if we shifted the focus from movement form, idealized patterns, just with the thought, like start watching your athletes. Is it even possible to use and desirable to use a particular form under certain conditions, right? So one trap is way too much focus on specific movement forms and trying to get them, even worse, trying to get those forms explicitly through instruction. Because that will then lead you to the trap of internal focus of attention that we know is bad, right? We want athletes focusing out. And I'm not saying movement form is unimportant. I know that there are some solutions that might be locally okay, may solve the task, but as soon as you are in a more dynamic situation, it won't work. So you want to make sure the athlete experience the lack of success of particular strategies so that they move away from them and start discovering better strategies. Because functionally, they, you know, particular strategies make more sense than others.
If you did see something that was a potential injury, would that be a time where like you got to jump in with verbal instruction, or do you still want to constrain that out?
I think, you know, like I'm saying, I do this work with the anterior cruciate ligament prevention, that we're trying to have individuals learn patterns that are safe without explicit instruction. And the group that this research is led by Mike Riley and Greg Meyer. And Greg also works with another group of researchers looking at brain patterns during recovery from injury, ligament injury. And they're beginning to see that this excessive instruction that people start giving when athletes are injured, they just promote a tendency that's already natural of those athletes to be really afraid of movement and really internally focused. And then what we do is, without wanting to, without meaning to, making it worse by telling them, be careful, don't do this, don't do that, right? Preventing particular movements through instruction. If they can't do particular movements, then organize the training in a way that is not, that doesn't require them, instead of instructing them not to do particular things while trying to do tasks that would potentially require those things that you're telling them to avoid.
John, were there any other common traps that you thought of?
No, I feel like the internal focus and the, they go hand to hand, like she was saying, when you are focused on how to move versus trying to
the task you're trying
perform,
to
perform effectively, right? Yeah. I don't know. Did you have one?
No, I think that was,
yeah.
Yeah. That covers a lot. That's a big umbrella.
Yeah.
And remember, it's not to say that people don't get better
right
at producing the idealized form when you right. teach them the idealized form. They do.
Right.
But does that create an anti-fragile athlete?
Right.
I don't think it does, because all research in motor control suggests that performance is stabilized when movement varies in a way that guarantees that performance. Yeah. Not because you keep producing the you. When people learn, they don't learn to produce a specific movement pattern. Mm-hmm. They learn to vary movement patterns according to contextual conditions to stabilize performance. That's what they learn, right?
That's a really good point, because I feel like I learned this. Dr. Andy Bass talked about, like, it's really hard to get negative transfer. So like us as coaches, we could almost do anything. It's like, oh yeah, they're improving.
Yeah.
But are we using the most effective? Are we developing anti-fragile? Like, that's a whole nother story, right? But yep. almost anything we can do will like lead to some, you know, some positive transfer. So that's a great point.
So we've talked a lot about, you know, a lot of the conditions. Coaches talk about stress as a negative experience that mm-hmm. we want to help athletes avoid or get through. And it seems that you view stress, and your research suggests that stress is a benefit. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you can take us through how stress can be beneficial and how it is beneficial.
Okay. So the first thing, I think we need to unpack what I mean by stress when I talk about stress, because my body of research is all about physical performance. So when I talk about stress, I'm not talking about, you know, you're stressed out because you're afraid of losing the game. You're stressed out because, oh my gosh, a championship is coming up. I'm not talking about that stress. And I'm not saying that stress is bad either, but the stress I'm talking about is any particular physical challenge that you can impose in your athlete during performance. So my point when I talk about stress as being positive is that there is no growth without it. And we know that pretty well when we think about component processes supporting performance. And I already talked about that with you guys before we started the show, muscle strength being one of them. We're very good at understanding that to build strength, you need to stress the muscle. And stress meaning you need to load it, right? So you need to know what the particular athlete, imagine you want the biceps to be stronger. You need to know what load they're used to carrying. And what you do, you increase that load and make them exercise at a level of load that's still within their capability, right? It's not like you make them exercise with a load that's bigger than what they can move, because that doesn't do anything. You select perhaps 80% of their maximum capacity, 70% of their maximum capacity, depending on whether you want to build resistance or strength, and we make people perform under a load that they're not used to, right? And that's the kind of stress I'm talking about.
So when we have a team of, you know, 15, 18, 20 people, how do you know what the appropriate level of stress is for each person? And in your research, you mentioned that you can measure some stuff. Is that sort of measurable stuff possible in a live, you know, in the wild sports setting?
I like how, Andrew raised his hand here on the Zoom for Professor Silva, like, please call me as she was. I have a question, Professor. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, again, as I was saying, we're very good at doing that for component processes like muscle strength, flexibility. You may have 15 athletes. You don't use the same load for all 15 of them. You apply the same principles. You're going to pick the load that is about 80% of that person's maximum strength, right? And what you're asking is very interesting. And I think that's one of the things that I want to discover with my research is how to transfer that philosophy to more functional tasks. What is a, and we're doing this in navigation tasks right now. So what is a more difficult scenario? How can I order difficulty in a navigation scenario? So imagine your player needs to go from position A to position B in the field. How do I order scenarios as a function of difficulty? Is it the number of obstacles in the middle that they have to swerve around? Is that sufficient for me to say, oh, if you have just one, it's harder than two, than three? Is it about how those obstacles are moving? Is it how much expertise those obstacles have? Because those obstacles could be opponents. So depending on how much they can read of what you're going to do, maybe you have just one, but that one makes it really, really hard because that person knows what is your, and what it is that you want to do.
I mean, is it appropriate for coaches to just lean on their eye and their gut feel for, you know, we have these players who can probably hit a target this small. Mm-hmm. And then we have these players who can probably hit a target this small. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it just kind of goes tiered.
Yeah, I think for now, that's what we have, right? So let's say you want to do...
Until you create an app for us.
Right?
That is on their Apple Watch where we can tell how they're responding.
It is true. But in general, I think one of the things that I would suggest that we should do that, you know, we can do right now, instead of... you can systematize this thing that you just said. Imagine you have a particular exercise to help players... hit the ball towards a target that is very intentional, right? And then you can, like you said, the size of the target could be a dimension you want to vary to vary difficulty of the task, to stress the athlete, let's say, right? Because you're changing a dimension of the task that will require adaptation. Now, instead of just assuming based on like unsystematic observation that this athlete is better than that athlete, you can say, hey, athlete, that I want to train, I want to give you this challenge. I'm going to have you do this task and try to hit the ball on a target. And I'm going to vary the size of the target. You can do it systematically, right? Give a small, give a medium, give a large, give various sizes and build a performance curve. Have them do the task like multiple times for each one of the conditions. And then watch what happens with performance. What you want is to give a difficulty level that's not their maximum. Because when they're in their maximum demand, when you're in maximum demand, basically, you can basically just do the task in one way. So you're not fostering variability. Does that make sense? If I have you carry a table that is at your limit of capacity, you probably have like one way of doing it that will do the trick. If I give you intermediate level of difficulty, that's where you pull out the flexibility and the creativity, because that's the level of difficulty that will... allow that, right? If it's too easy, maybe it doesn't pull out creativity because it's, you know, if I just do it this one way, I get it. So why should I change? If you're in the intermediate zone, that's when, you know, it's a little bit challenging. So it requires me to explore possibilities. If it's way too hard, then, you know, you just use all your resources. So there's no creativity there either.